This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Diabetes is an important health issue in the USA today. Pregnancy and the complications of pregnancy is also a topic that's always been of great importance. Put those two issues together and you have gestational diabetes, the number one complication of pregnancy.
There's risk for the baby in utero, and then there's risk for the rest of its life.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk to a dietitian about this growing health problem.
We'll also find out about one of those rare disorders that probably needs a little more attention than it gets. Today, a wake-up call about narcolepsy. And we'll find out how humans are learning to cope with a 24-hour world. Here's a hint, we're not doing so good. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Before we start today, I'd like to go back to a segment from a couple of weeks ago that got a lot of reaction from listeners. That was my conversation with Dr. Marina Johnson about hormone replacement therapy and her book, Outliving Your Ovaries. This is still a controversial topic in healthcare, but there was one statement Dr. Johnson made at the end of the piece that got the most comment. And Nina, I think I'd like to hear your thoughts. I mentioned that recovering breast cancer patients should avoid HRT, and here's what Dr. Johnson said.
In general, that's true. In the course of their treatment, oncologists always withdraw any estrogen. However, after the breast cancer has been treated and cured, then some oncologists say a time of 5 years or longer has passed, the woman is disease-free. In some instances, if the woman's quality of life is very poor as a result of low estrogen, they will allow them to take small doses of estrogen, provided they're being closely monitored. But that's an individual decision that has to be made by the oncologist and the woman.
Okay, so Nina, you were not here that week when we ran that piece, and I'm sure you have some thoughts about those comments. What do you think?
Well, I think the way Dr. answered the question, I want us to be clear, she was saying that in a very rare instance, when a patient's symptoms of hormone deprivation outweigh perhaps the risk of hormone replacement therapy, she can talk to her oncologist and on a case-by-case basis, perhaps a low dose may be in order. However, that doesn't mean that breast cancer survivors should start hormone replacement or a phytoestrogen, which means something they can buy over the counter, without discussing this thoroughly with their oncologist. I, for one, would never take hormone replacement as a breast cancer survivor.
Mm-hmm.
So I really feel that we need to understand the biology of our tumor, okay? Now, our oncologist can help us do that, whether they're sensitive to estrogens, whether they weren't, and then have a thorough discussion about this. It really depends on what we're talking about, symptoms of hormone deprivation. In other words, we may be talking about something as simple as vaginal dryness, and there are estrogen very low dose suppositories that may be appropriate for some women years after breast cancer treatment, and that's a quality of life issue. So we really do have to balance in that case quality of life years after breast cancer treatment versus certain risk factors. There have been studies that show that even those low dose estrogen suppositories or creams for the vaginal area do result in an elevation of estrogen systemically. This area is evolving, but I just don't see that women who are breast cancer survivors should be taking hormone replacement at this time, unless there are certain factors that in any one individual may make them make this decision. So really, you need to speak to your oncologist about your particular breast cancer and get your oncologist's recommendations.
This is definitely not a do-it-yourself issue.
Not at all. It really is a complex issue. Really, talk to your doctor, ladies. Don't do this on your own.
It's no secret that diabetes is one of the fastest growing health problems in the U.S., and it's been getting a lot of needed attention in the media. But when we talk about diabetes, it's usually type 2 diabetes, and sometimes type 1. There is, however, another type of diabetes affecting scores of pregnant women every day, gestational diabetes. I recently attended a seminar on gestational diabetes, and one of the speakers was Connie Crawley, a registered dietitian and a nutrition and health specialist at the University of Georgia Cooperative Extension. We sat down after her session, and I noted that something she said that got my attention was that gestational diabetes is the number one complication of pregnancy.
Exactly right. We know that all types of diabetes are actually the number one complication of pregnancy, but it's an under-identified complication that many people just don't see as very important. So we really want to get the message out that this is something that is really important for women to take seriously.
Is gestational diabetes actual diabetes? It just works the same way as the regular disease does?
Yeah, every type of diabetes has high blood glucose in common. So high blood glucose is just not good for the body. It really affects the organs, it affects how the cells work. And in gestational diabetes, we're really worried about how it affects the baby.
And how does that? One thing that was interesting that I heard was that once the baby is born, that baby is at risk because of all the high glucose it's been getting from the placenta?
Right, right. There's risk for the baby in utero, and there's risk for the baby once it's born, and then there's risk for the rest of its life, which most people don't realize. So in utero, the baby can grow very quickly and be difficult to deliver. After the pregnancy is over, after the child's been delivered, there's a risk that they would get low blood sugar, which can be dangerous to the baby's brain. And then because they've been exposed to all that blood sugar while they've been in the uterus, they are more at risk for having weight problems as they get older, actually developing type 2 diabetes themselves. So it really is a serious public health issue for the mother and the baby and child as it gets older.
Well, let's go back to the mother. While the mother is still pregnant, what types of treatments, what are we looking for therapies?
The number one thing, first of all, is medical nutrition therapy, which means that they have to eat a good, healthy diet that has controlled carbohydrate. And then we look also at calories because we don't want them gaining too much weight. We want them to be physically active as well because we know that helps with weight control. And then if they cannot control their blood glucose with the diet and exercise, then we sometimes have to go to insulin or an oral medication called glyburide. So we try and avoid the medications, but sometimes there is a certain group that will require it.
Are there certain types of pregnancies that are more troublesome, say multiple birth?
Well, anytime there's a multiple birth, then we usually have to restrict the physical activity. But multiple births are always a high-risk pregnancy. Most people don't realize that. But we know that, again, the woman has to gain adequate weight because if she has gestational diabetes, there is a risk that if she has something called ketones, that would adversely affect the baby's brain development. So we always have to be careful about any kind of multiple births. And because people are having this artificial insemination type things that they're doing, multiple births are more common now. And so we really do have to watch these women much more carefully.
You mentioned ketones, and that's something that we've heard with low-carbohydrate diets, right? So this really has to be a balancing act with diet.
Yeah. We don't want these women to have low-carb diets. We want them to have a moderate intake of carbohydrate that's spaced evenly throughout the day so they don't have an over amount of carbohydrate at any one time that raises the blood sugar. So we want common, just even amounts, consistent amounts of carbohydrate throughout the day so the woman has enough blood glucose for the baby and herself, but not too much.
Once the child is born, how long does it take for a mother's body to get back to normal? And I know we're talking about generalities here, but let's say the average patient.
Well, first of all, we're going to encourage her to breastfeed because we know that helps with blood glucose control and weight control. We're also going to encourage her to be physically active as soon as she can after the delivery. Now, if she has a C-section, that's not going to be possible right away. But by 6 weeks, we want her to be back into some sort of physical activity. And then we're going to counsel her on how to eat healthy for the rest of her life. We aren't talking about dieting. We're talking about healthy eating that produces a healthy weight. And a healthy weight is the weight that that woman achieves with regular physical activity, at least 30 minutes every day, and also a good, healthy eating pattern. Where lots of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, not a lot of fatty foods, lean meats, chicken and fish, and low-fat or non-fat dairy products. So it is not magic. It's a good way that everybody should eat.
Does this mean that she is going to be at risk for the rest of her life for developing regular type 2 diabetes?
Yes, she is much more at risk for getting type 2 as she gets older. In fact, a majority of these women will convert to type 2 diabetes within 5 to 10 years if they do not control their weight and if they are not physically active. If they are not taught to do the right things, then unfortunately they are much more likely to get type 2 fairly quickly.
How soon after a pregnancy is, you know, they find out they're pregnant, should they be, you know, monitored or tested for this?
If they know that they have a strong family history of diabetes, or if they've had a large baby previously, or if they are overweight, well, every woman should really go in and see their doctor for their first prenatal visit during that first trimester. The minute they think that they're pregnant, they need to go in and get early prenatal care. But these women especially need that because that baby is there very much more at risk. So I say early visit with their doctor, regular appointments, seeing a dietitian, looking into what they can do to walk or be physically active in some other way. It's just going to make them healthier overall, and it's going to make it easier for them to deliver that baby. It's going to be possibly a more normal-sized baby that's just going to be a lot healthier.
If they get tested, say, 8 weeks along and everything looks fine, does that mean 4 months along, 5 months along, it's still going to be okay, or should the monitoring keep going?
Well, normally, if they are tested early, they will be tested again at 24 to 28 weeks again, because it's when the hormones start to rise that we start seeing the glucose intolerance, the higher blood sugars. So even if they're okay early, they still will probably go through that screening again at 24 to 28 weeks. So it's sort of mid-pregnancy, they'll be looked at again. And it's just wise to have that done. Ignorance is not bliss when you're a pregnant woman. And what gives you that opportunity is that early contact with your healthcare provider is making it much more likely that you're educated, and you know what to do, and that there's no surprises. And that's what you want during a pregnancy.
Connie Crawley is a registered dietitian and a nutrition and health specialist at the University of Georgia Cooperative Extension.
Still to come, if you find yourself dozing during the next segment, that might not be our fault. We'll explain next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1258.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. Narcolepsy is a rare chronic disorder of the central nervous system. It affects only about 1 in 200,000 people, but those people have symptoms ranging from annoying to life-threatening. From the National Institutes of Health, Joe Belinfi reports.
Imagine if you couldn't control when and where you fall asleep.
When patients have narcolepsy, they fall asleep during the day.
And suddenly, says NIH researcher Dr. Giovanni Chiesa, in narcolepsy, the brain is unable to control sleep-wake cycles. So people with narcolepsy experience irresistible and sudden bouts of sleep. Those sleep episodes can last from a few seconds to several minutes. And Dr. Chiesa adds they can be dangerous.
So there was a lady who, with narcolepsy, suffering from narcolepsy, who liked to swim, and she only could go if someone continuously watched her because she could fall asleep while swimming.
In addition to sleep episodes during waking hours and sleep disturbances at night, another symptom of narcolepsy is called cataplexy,
which is when the muscle tone disappears.
The loss of muscle tone in cataplexy can be barely noticeable, involving no more than a momentary sense of slight weakness in a limited number of muscles. For example, mild drooping of the eyelids. The most severe attacks result in a complete loss of tone in all voluntary muscles. This leads to total physical collapse, during which individuals are unable to move, speak, or even keep their eyes open. But even during the most severe episodes of cataplexy, people remain fully conscious, a characteristic that distinguishes it from seizure disorders. Dr. Chiza notes that narcolepsy, even though the symptoms are very specific and unusual, is often undiagnosed.
I have seen many subjects with narcolepsy who told me that it took many years for them to be diagnosed. And most often they were diagnosed either by themselves or by friends, non-physicians.
He adds that usually the subjects go through a lot of other diagnoses, such as depression, hypothyroidism, or chronic fatigue syndrome, but it may be many years before a diagnosis of narcolepsy.
There was a gentleman who had had narcolepsy for a long time, and when he was growing up, his father would scold him and sometimes beat him at the table because he would fall asleep at dinner. And then when maybe this person was 20, they invited for dinner a neurologist. It was a family friend, and the neurologist said, I think your son has narcolepsy. And that's how he was diagnosed.
Once diagnosed, dealing with narcolepsy is not easy. Dr. Chiza explains that there are medications that can treat narcolepsy. Some are expensive, others have more side effects. But he adds that awareness of the condition is also a big help.
Unfortunately, there is not the same awareness about the consequences of narcolepsy. For example, some of these subjects are discriminated because they are seen as lazy.
But Dr. Chiza points out that people with narcolepsy can manage the condition and be very successful.
If you adjust the environment, not too much, but if they can take, let's say, 10-15 minutes nap, they do okay. They do fine. But unfortunately, this is not always possible.
Narcolepsy affects both males and females equally and appears throughout the world. It most often starts in childhood or adolescence and is lifelong. Dr. Chiza is currently conducting a research study on narcolepsy at the NIH Clinical Center.
We're doing this study because these subjects may also have alteration in their metabolism, and we think that they may have problems in keeping their weight down unless they exercise vividly.
Dr. Chiza explains that the gene involved in narcolepsy is also involved in weight gain, in fact, obesity in some, even though they are not necessarily eating more calories, rather burning less. For more information about narcolepsy, visit nids.nih.gov/disorders/narcolepsy. This is Joe Belinfi.
For those of us who can stay awake for it, the world is now a 24-hour place. There are pluses and minuses to this. You can do your shopping or banking just about any time of day, and there's always a place to stop and get a snack. In the minus column, we're just not built to be up all hours of the night, and we're certainly not supposed to be crossing 10 time zones in 12 hours, leaving our bodies catching up for days. From Radio Netherlands, Marnie Chesterton has more.
There's an English word, discombobulated, a wonderful word, but what it really means is that your brain thinks it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Your liver is saying, no, actually, it's midnight. Your pancreas is saying, oh, it's 1 in the morning. Everything's out of sync, out of kilter, and you feel lousy. It doesn't stop you functioning, but you're not functioning as well as you could be. But I wouldn't trust a surgeon to be operating, and I wouldn't be all that happy with a lot of activities where there's a high level of skill, high level decision making being done by people who are jet lagged.
That's Leon Kreitzman, science writer and author of a book about the 24-hour society and what it does to us. He's ideally placed to explain when the concept first cropped up.
In one sense, it's almost as old as time itself, because there have been, in the last couple, 200-400 years ago, you started to get certain industries where they started to make iron that had to have fires going all the night, the furnaces would go all the night, the textile industry. I wrote a book about 15 years ago called The 24-Hour Society, and that was when it was becoming a much wider phenomenon. It wasn't just working classes working in the mines or what have you, it started to infiltrate into the middle classes. So you started to find banks being open at odd hours and traders working for banks working at odd hours. And so gradually we saw this erosion of the distinction between day working, night working, and so on. And so we now live in this 24-hour globalized, it's actually 24/7, 365 days a year society.
Which is nice if you want to go and do your shopping at 3 a.m. But I'm just wondering how one's body reacts if you work during the night. I spoke to shift worker Gerrit at Rotterdam Harbour, for example. What's going on in his body if he's working 4 a.m. shifts?
Well, it's not good for you. The problem is that we have this biological drive, if you like, to be up during the day and asleep at night. We're what's called diurnal creatures. And we have an internal clock. All the cells in our body actually beat to a rhythm, and it's coordinated by a master clock, which signals the time according to the solar cycle. Because we have an innate rhythm, which is nearly 24 hours, and it's pushed into a close 24 hours by dawn and dusk. The light comes, hits our eyes, gets transmitted to a special center in the brain, and that then signals to the rest of the body, effectively, this is the time. And at night, you shouldn't be working. You should be sleeping. You shouldn't be eating. You shouldn't be drinking. You shouldn't be doing physical activity. That's really meant for the daytime activity. So people who work at nights are, in a sense, out of sync with this internal rhythm, this internal clock.
But if Gerrit is able to have a good sleep during the day, why can't the body just kind of switch around? I mean, how would it know the difference?
Well, it can't just switch around because this is an innate basic rhythm. Your body never really adjusts to the fact that it's working out of sync. You sleep, let's say, for 8 hours. So let's say you've got a bank of sleep. But that starts to diminish as you do things. In order to keep going, there's a counter drive, which is this circadian rhythm, keeping you awake, and that gets you through the daytime. By the time nighttime comes, your body temperature is falling. You've exhausted, if you like, the sleep bank, so you sleep. And then the whole thing starts again the next 24 hours, the next day. If you're a shift worker, then the sorts of problems you start to develop are gastrointestinal problems like indigestion, heartburn, nausea. You'll have cardiovascular problems. There's a higher incidence of heart attack and heart disease. And there's quite a lot of evidence of things like diabetes and also mental health problems that do arise from this continually working out of synchronization with your internal clock. So it's not a good thing.
Okay. Do you think this is just a problem that's going to get worse? Are we all going to be chronically functioning in the future?
This is happening. We live in this globalizing world. We need to find time somewhere, so we take it from the night because that's the only place where we can get time. You can't create time. You can't manufacture it. What we really need to do is be a bit aware of some of the consequences. And I try to get daylight, and that's the single best thing that people can do. If you can spend at least half an hour every day outdoors in bright sunlight, that will be a big bonus.
That was Leon Kreitzman, author of The 24-Hour Society, speaking with Radio Netherlands' Marnie Chesterton. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.